Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We've got the North Carolina A&T Visual and Performing Arts University Choir with us today on the show. They're still jazzed from their two performances for the Obamas at the White House, and they're going to sing till the spirit moves in our hearts live in Studio A. Then we take a look back, way back, to post-Civil War North Carolina and the fascinating stories behind our state's many Civil War monuments. Author-photographer Douglas Butler has studied them all in his new book, and he's here with Tales to Tell. Later, on the heels of the science fiction television show Doctor Who's 50th anniversary, Eddie Garcia interviews Doctor Who comic book illustrator, Greensboro artist Kelly Yates. Kelly will be giving a talk and drawing live at Geeksboro this weekend, so buckle your TARDIS seatbelts. And it's the story of a little old nutcracker that could. At the UNCSA production of the Nutcracker Ballet, executive producer and general manager Catherine Laidlaw may have all the pocketbooks and headaches, but she's loving it. Next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And did you know that the North Carolina A&T Visual and Performing Arts University Choir has performed twice in the White House for President Obama and his family? Well, it's true, and for good reason. Under the direction of conductor Travis Alexander, this incredible ensemble has become well-known for tackling a huge variety of repertoire, including classical, jazz, and pop music, and tackling it well. The choir will perform a dynamic holiday program this weekend in the Metropolitan United Methodist Church in Greensboro. 14 choristers of the 30-plus member A&T University Choir recently visited the WFDD studios to chat and sing for us live in Studio A. Well, I got to start with traveling and playing at the White House experience, and this is not just once but twice. What's that whole preparation process like to play for the president and family?
Well, it's quite grueling, and it was unexpected. The first invitation was totally unexpected.
How did it come about?
I still do not know. I just got a call on my cell phone, and they said it was the White House, and I hung up because I thought it was a student playing a trick on me. And they called again the next day, and I said, you got to show me some proof. And then they sent something on email, and they told me a few things. And then I realized it really was the White House.
Wow. Now, I know that the Obamas were big into North Carolina, or still are. They like this neck of the woods. But obviously, beyond that, you have an excellent program. And since then, have you any indication as to why they selected the group?
No, even when she came back to do the graduation last year and we sang for her, she met with us personally before she would go out on the stage to give the commencement address. She wished us well. She thanked us for coming. But still, there was still no clue on why we were asked other than we were a solid group and had done some great things. And so we're happy to be a part of it. And it was for Black History, so that was more poignant for us to sing Negro spirituals. And we did classical as well, jazz, little blues, and gospel, all in the White House.
Nice mix. Were you all there?
Yes. Did
you? Okay, well, I got to go around the room and get the student take on this. Beginning with you, Stacey, tell me about that experience. What was it like, and what stands out in your memory?
The whole experience was very surreal. Like he said, it was very unexpected, and the whole process, like he said, was very grueling. A lot of auditions, a lot of extra rehearsals and everything. So just the whole process that, like, I'm actually standing inside of the White House singing, you know, what I love to do. It was just an amazing experience.
When you think back on that experience, what images come to mind?
Just the whole house, the piano that Mr. Alexander did play on, all of the pictures, all of the just the memories that, you know, was in that house. They have, of course, pictures of every president and everything that's, you know, that's in that's inside of the house. It was breathtaking, honestly.
And I'll throw that your way, too, Jasmine. I mean, you probably had, as anyone would, some preconceptions as to what that experience would be like once you're there. How did it compare, and what stands out in your memory?
Well, when we got there, we couldn't take pictures or anything, but we worked really hard for it. It was something like we were really excited to do. And I always will remember standing outside, and we're all like really excited, like giggly to go inside. But at the same time, we have to keep our composure to, you know, be professional. And when we went inside, we just took it all in because you couldn't take a picture. You just had to really like look for yourself. You had to look around and basically keep those in your mind. And then there was, like she said, a lot of pictures of like famous people and people that we study, like Leontine Price, pictures of her singing, you know, in the White House. And that's big for us. Right. It was really big for us.
The great soprano from the 1950s and 60s, famed singer and revered. What a voice. Well, thanks for sharing your all's memories there. And I want to get one from James as well. Tell me what, what was the best part of that trip from your perspective?
The best part of the trip to the White House the first time was going
actually into the building. There were some situations where we weren't sure if we were going to make it in. But walking into the building, going down into the holding area, and just soaking in all of the famous artists who had frequented the building, seeing the signatures and the autographs all over the wall, the pictures, and being in the same room as some of the people that we hear on the radio, some of the people that we attend their concerts, being in the same room where they were was breathtaking. And we couldn't speak a lot because we were preparing to perform. But there were many tears, a lot of people crying, just taking in the experience. I'm tearing thinking about it. It was breathtaking, just an amazing opportunity.
Mm. What does that do to you as a performer?
First, it's humbling. I became very humble immediately. That's hard for me to do sometimes. But I became very humble in that moment, just to be in that space, in that particular time, having done all of the hard work and all of the preparation.
Yeah. And when you look back on that experience, I mean, drawing from that moving forward, then how does that impact you as a performer?
It just makes me want to work hard and, you know, continue to like do classical music and not just the stuff that we hear on the radio. You know, we did so much in the White House. It was different genres all over. We didn't just do one. And that like really made me want to be able to sing everything like for the rest of my life, pretty much. I loved it.
What a great experience. Speaking of the repertoire, though, when you're putting together these programs, what sorts of considerations do you have? I mean, we've just heard a tremendous variety here.
And this is just like an ensemble that I pulled yesterday from the choir. So the choir is, of course, twice this size, or if not three times. Basically, I have to consider the occasion. I have to consider what voicing I'm working with. Each semester, we have a different group of students, and especially every year, it may change. Students graduate. Right now, I have a whole new group of students minus these four or five. And so I have to consider that. Do I have more men? Do I have ladies? And what repertoire would fit best with the voicing that I have to work with, as well as their ability?
Now, and you are one, a strong believer in pairing the Negro spiritual with classical music, with contemporary and pop music.
Most definitely.
Why is that important?
Well, because the Negro spiritual is American music. This is the contributions that African Americans have made to America. And so it should stand right up there with Verdi and anybody else, because these composers who arranged these spirituals were trained. They went to Ivy League schools and got their education. Not all of them went just to Howard. They went to Eastman and Juilliard and places, very talented musicians. And they arranged it in a European style, still keeping the African idiom. So it is great classical music. And I always pair that music with of course the core repertoire, as well as pop, because we have to reach everybody, and that's a form, but everything must be done well, whether it's jazz, whether it's gospel. We use the same care with those genres as we do Verdi or William Grant Steele.
Mm. And of course, one of the great arrangers in that realm of the spiritual is Moses Hogan.
Of course.
Well, I happen to know you have a choir with you today. Will you treat us to a number? What are we going
to
hear today?
Sing to the Spirit moves in my heart, one of his more popular spirituals, especially among the college and the high school choirs.
Moses Hogan, and this is the North Carolina A&T Visual and Performing Arts University Choir.
I'm going to sing till the Spirit moves in my heart. I'm going to sing till the Spirit moves in my heart. I'm going to sing till the Spirit moves in my heart. I'm going to sing till Jesus comes. I'm going to sing
all my Jesus. Oh, my Jesus, 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 till he comes, sing, oh, my Jesus, 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 till he comes.
Jesus, oh my Jesus.
Jesus, till me comes Shalom, my Jesus. Oh, my Jesus, oh, oh my Jesus. Oh, my Jesus, oh, oh my Jesus. Oh, my Jesus, oh, oh my Jesus. Till he comes, I'm gonna sing. Till my Jesus.
I'm going to sing till the Spirit moves in my heart. Moses Hogan arranges the great Negro spiritual, and that is, once again, the North Carolina A&T Visual and Performing Arts University Choir, directed by Travis Alexander. And we've got Jasmine Boone, James Thomas, and Stacy Lyles with us here in the studio following that great performance. I've seen great performances of Negro spirituals in performance in the church, and this is one of those. I get goosebumps. What do you all feel when you're singing this great music? I'll throw it your way first.
Pretty much the same as you. Goosebumps. It makes me feel good inside. It's something that I want to dance, but I know that I can't. So I guess you could say that I'm kind of dancing with my voice. It's so much fun just to sing. I really like singing spirituals.
I should say that was Jasmine to start off with. Stacy, how about yourself? I guess I would wonder how you rein in those emotions and are able to project and do all the things vocally that you're supposed to do with all that emotion going on. But what's it feel like?
It feels like I'm conveying the message, you know, what the composer wanted to convey. And especially if it's done correctly, you know, you can move somebody to want to say, oh, yeah, that was done very, very well. And so that's what I want to do when I sing. I want to make sure that I convey everything that the composer wanted to happen.
This is an off-perform work, but it's not easy. And I'm wondering what the challenges are from your perspective. And by the way, some really strong male voices to balance out the powerful soprano section, which was refreshing to hear.
Thank you, sir. It's reflective. I like to try to tap into the mind of a Negro in the slavery times and try to communicate with the other choir members and use the spiritual as a means of communication. So speaking to each other, I'm going to sing till the Spirit moves in my heart. Let it move from heart to heart and from breast to breast and kind of communicate it that way. And hopefully doing that, the message will come off clearly to the audience.
That is something that's so, you finally put into words something that I either feel in the audience or do not. It's either a disconnected performance or we're all on the same page. We're all in this together. And that sort of communication really came through in your all's performance. From the conductor's podium, Mr. Alexander, how do you get that out? How do you bring that out in performance?
Practice. Habitually doing things over and over to get the phrases the way I want them. Because if you're singing, sing to the Spirit moves in my heart, the music must have rhythmic drive. It must be spirited. The diction must be clear because the Negro spiritual must be heard and understood. And bringing out, in that spiritual, it has move, moving, moving. And it goes from the tenor to the alto to the soprano. And the bass is sort of like the church person urging it on, can't you feel it moving? And so I've used the analogy of the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost, moving from heart to heart and breast to breast, and each individual was filled with the Spirit at a different time, but then it all came together. So that's how we approach that section of the moving part that starts out in Divisi but ends up in one big collaboration.
Let's move into the holiday spirit with Torches by Thomas Matthews. Well, you need some strong male voices to bring this off.
You do need some strong male voices. It's a lovely piece. He's not a well-known composer. He was around New York area, around the Union Theological School of Music, where a lot of his colleagues were attending there for graduate schools and choral music. And so it's a beautiful piece. It goes through a lot of changes in a short period of time. It has the ladies sort of on a lullaby while the guys take the lead and then vice versa. It ranges in dynamics from pianissimo to fortissimo. Just a lovely little piece all about going to see the newborn king. Bring your torches all the way to Bethlehem.
All right. All that wrapped up in one nice little 3-minute piece. Let's hear it live in Studio A. This is the North Carolina A&T Visual and Performing Arts University Choir. Torches by Thomas Matthews.
Torches, run with torches all the way to Bethlehem.
That was Torches, performed by the North Carolina A&T Visual and Performing Arts University Choir, music by Thomas Matthews. And talk about that rehearsal process. I want to hear from the students' perspective. They've got to go through this rather challenging process. How long are the rehearsals? And talk me through, how does it typically work?
Rehearsals, we rehearse every day of the week at 1 o'clock. Because that's our class meeting time. And then afterwards, we'll have an extra rehearsal from about 5 to 6:15. And sometimes if we need, we'll get sectionals going during the day. And we just kind of, you know, work on the pieces one by one, section by section. And then next thing you know, it's all coming together. We don't necessarily start from the beginning of a piece. We just work in sections and it comes together.
Stacey, put it in perspective, because you're taking classes at the same time and extracurricular stuff. I mean, how do you balance it all? How do you juggle all those things?
It's all about time management. You know, you definitely have your courses and you have your lessons. You have your classes. Some you have to eat. You have to sleep. Sleeping definitely is a luxury in college. But the rehearsal schedules, it's very demanding. But in the end, you definitely reap what you sow.
The proof is in the pudding, and we just heard it right here, live in Studio A. And now, for the larger work on the program, this is a piece that brings transparent writing, 2D writing, soloists, I mean, the whole male chorus, female chorus. Tell me about the piece, first off. This is an exciting one.
The piece is based on a hymn arranged by David Clydesdale, How Great Thou Art. It's a familiar hymn, I think, that's kind of ecumenical. And I found this arrangement not long ago, and I did it with my church choir in Charlotte, and we got such rave reviews, and I had a few students to sing with me in that performance, and they asked me to bring it and use it with the university choir, because that's not typically a piece I would choose for the choir. And they love it. And so we've performed it, and it goes through all of its paces, from having a soloist, from having divided choirs, from the tutti to starting out a big instrumental interlude with big crashing chords for the pianist. So it's a workout for everybody.
All right. Well, let's work out. Live in Studio A, the North Carolina A&T Visual and Performing Arts University Choir, directed by Travis Alexander. And this is How Great Thou Art, arranged by David Clydesdale. The North Carolina A&T Visual and Performing Arts University Choir. We heard from director Travis Alexander and from choir members James Thomas, Stacey Lyles, and Jasmine Boone. Together with the rest of their peers, first semester freshmen to graduating seniors, they'll sing a holiday concert Sunday night, December 8th at 4 o'clock in the Metropolitan United Methodist Church in Greensboro. The performance is free and open to the public, so audience members from all across the Triad can hear for themselves why the A&T University Choir has been invited to perform not once, but twice at the White House in Washington, D.C. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And when we get back from this little intermission, we'll learn everything you ever wanted to know about North Carolina Civil War monuments, but we're afraid to ask. Author, photographer, adventurer, and scholar Douglas Butler has waded through reams and reams of fascinating primary source material to bring us the answers. You can find them in his new book, North Carolina Civil War Monuments, An Illustrated History, and right here when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. In researching his new book, North Carolina Civil War Monuments, An Illustrated History, author-photographer Douglas Butler plowed through thousands of pages of financial documents, letters, and other primary source materials. In doing so, he was able to painstakingly piece together the stories behind each of the more than 100 Civil War monuments scattered across our state. Doug's clear and informative prose is accompanied by the artful photographic images he captured of each North Carolina monument. Some of these monuments, handcrafted with expensive tools and materials, others, not so much, and for good reason.
That's right. Cost was a major factor. North Carolina was broke after the Civil War. All the Confederate currency was worthless. State debts were repudiated. There was very little hard capital in North Carolina. And so cost was a major factor. Early on, some of the monuments were rather modest obelisks put up in cemeteries marking the mass graves of the Confederate dead. And when it went to the civic space monuments in about 1900, late 1890s, on up through the first and second decade of the 1900s, cost was a major factor. Some of the monuments, the statues, for instance, were mass-produced stamped metal figures from northern factories. Others were copies that were forged, and some were cheaply produced imitations carved overseas in the low-wage countries by low-wage artisans, and in this case, it was in Germany and Italy. There were only about three or four major North Carolina monuments that were commissioned sculptures. Included in those three would be Silent Sam at UNC Chapel Hill, Fame, the monument in Salisbury, and the soldier figure atop the Oakdale Cemetery Monument in Wilmington, North Carolina, are three of the most notable commissioned sculptures.
Regardless of the cost of the memorials, grieving and finding ways to memorialize soldiers, that's going on. What did you discover along those lines that maybe surprised you?
One of the things that surprised me was the evolution of the grief process as demonstrated through the monuments. I compared it to the five stages of the Kubler-Ross grieving process that a lot of people see. And going back through the history of the monuments, you notice early on, the first Confederate monument in the South was put up in South Carolina, just across the border in Cheraw, South Carolina. And it showed a toppled palmetto tree. It was uprooted. It said fallen but not dead. It was still in a state of denial. After that came anger and depression, with symbolism of the destroyed South and just utter devastation in the wording, our Confederate dead, our fellow citizens, our beloved dead, etc. By about 35 or 40 years later, in the early 1900s, some resolution was beginning to show through. Citizens were honoring Confederate veterans as well as the dead, and there was more of an acceptance that the war had been lost, this great tragedy had occurred, but we're moving on. The South is improving. North Carolina's advancing. And then finally, by the 1930s, there seemed to be a full rationalization and acceptance. Oftentimes, the Star Spangled Banner would be played as well as Dixie. The American flag would fly, as would the Confederate battle flag. And in one speech in particular, somebody said, "Don't let this monument cause any old hatreds or bitterness to rise up. We're all Americans. We're proud to be Americans. We're a unified country, and that's the way it should be.
Of the 101-plus memorials you photographed, 8 or 9 of them were to Union troops.
That's correct. There's 109 Civil War monuments in North Carolina, 101 are Confederate, and 8 are Union.
Of those 8, how many of those were produced by or created by and for those with Union sensibilities? Or were they created by transplants?
The first Union monument was sponsored by the federal government. It was put up in Salisbury at the site of the former Confederate prison at the mass graves that over 11,000 Union soldiers died at the Salisbury prison. And this monument was put up in the mid-1870s. We don't have an exact date. The contract called for it to be put up before December 31st, 1876. It was 50 feet high, paid for by the federal government, and topped with a laurel wreath, the laurel wreath of victory, announcing the federal government had won. The next Union commemorations were put up by individual states, and 6 states put up commemorations in the national cemeteries. 2 were in Salisbury National Cemetery and 4 in New Bern Cemetery. And these were put up by individual states between 1894 and 1911.
Salisbury mentioned several times in this. Why was that a focal point for memorials?
Salisbury was a very important city. It was a transportation hub in North Carolina, a main stop on the North Carolina Railroad, and one of the most prominent cities in the state at that time. It was also the site of the Confederate prison, which had a large number of Union fatalities. The number was approximately 11,700, the second highest fatality total after Andersonville. And it was a wealthy town, it was a transportation hub, and it just became a focus of commemorative activity from each side.
It's just a fascinating time in our history, and you're seeing it from so many different perspectives. I'm wondering what else might, surprise the layperson about what went into making the decision to build monuments here versus there and competing interests.
There were a lot of competing interests because different groups tried to advance their own version of public memory. The war definitely had been lost. All the symbolism and prose on the monuments clearly stated that. But each group tried to advance their own vision of what the war had been about and what it had accomplished. There were groups that wanted to honor the Confederate soldiers. They did not necessarily want to praise the defeat of Confederacy, but they wanted to honor the men who had fought and died in defense of North Carolina and the Confederate States. There were other groups that really wanted to forget about the war, and there's some very spirited editorial exchanges that I came across. People said, we should just forget about this war. And other people said, no, we must remember these men who died because they gave so much.
North Carolina Civil War Monuments and Illustrated History, author, photographer, physician, adventurer, Douglas Butler. Doug and his work are part of the Associated Artists of Winston-Salem pop-up exhibition and art sale at 113 Rinalda Village near the Village Tavern. And on Sunday, December 7th from 11 to 3, he'll hold a book event there for his recent publication, North Carolina Civil War Monuments and Illustrated History, out on McFarland Press. Doug's solo photo exhibition at Wake Forest Law and Business Clinic will remain on display through January 31st. And you'll find links to some of his images at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a hard turn right now from Dixie to Doctor Who. Actually, Eddie's going to take that turn, and I, like you, am just along for the ride. So let's jump on in the TARDIS, buckle our seatbelts, and get set for an intergalactic trip around the world of triad art with Eddie Garcia.
Greensboro artist Kelly Yates is one of those rare people who've had their pop culture dream fulfilled. I mean, how many artists get the opportunity to draw the comic book version of their favorite television program, especially one with the rich history of Doctor Who? You can meet Kelly Yates on Saturday, December 7th at Geeksboro Cafe in Greensboro. Kelly will be giving an artist talk, doing a live drawing illustration that will be projected on a large screen, and telling stories about his experiences interacting with the creative team behind Doctor Who. The event begins at 2 p.m. Kelly also has two of his own comic book series, Amber Adams, which is described as an adventure book starring a female Flash Gordon type, and Monster, about a halfway house for monsters trying to become human again. You can find digital versions of these and his Doctor Who comics online, and we'll post links at wfdd.org. Now, being a comic book fan and a Doctor Who fan, I was pretty excited to talk to Kelly and to get him to sign my comic. I tempered my enthusiasm, and we had a great conversation, and we started off talking about how and when he started drawing.
I've always enjoyed comic books. You know, I've been reading comic books since I was about 12 years old. And, you know, that's one of those things you kind of keep, you don't talk about a lot back then, especially during the 80s. You know, you didn't talk to your high school friends like, oh, I read comic books. And I think the last time I actually taken an art class was like maybe ninth grade. So for me, you know, I was pushed into sports. So I didn't really have a huge art background. So, you know, I started going to college at UNCG studying exercise sports science for 3.5 years. And UNCG is a great school, but it just wasn't the right fit for me. And, you know, I was like, I just love comic books. I want to be involved in them. So for me, it really was like a leap of faith at 21 years old to quit UNCG after 3.5 years and go to Guilford Technical Community College to get a degree in commercial art and computer graphics.
Wow.
So as I'm doing that, I'm taking like life drawing classes, you know, staying up all hours of the night, just studying anatomy and just over the years cultivating that art style. I have all these great artist friends I've met throughout the years. I mean, people who've worked on Star Wars movies and, you know, have worked directly with Lucas and Spielberg and people that are incredibly talented, but they have all these great stories. Oh, I started drawing when I was 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and here I am starting, deciding to draw for a living at 21. So for me, you know, I'm 42 now. I feel like I have to play catch up. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge motivator for me. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm behind them. I'm 21 years behind them creatively. So I'm always playing catch up, which is a great motivator for me.
Do you have some certain artists or comics that really help to ignite your passion for drawing?
For me, it's more about meeting those artists I really like. Like Olivier Vatine, he's a big French artist that I've gotten to know over the years. And Ian McKeag, which he's a guy, again, who worked directly with Spielberg and Lucas. You know, he designed Darth Maul. He did all the Queen Amidala outfits. So meeting these people and being influenced by their passion and their love and how they draw things, I can learn from things they do, pick up little techniques or tricks and, you know, motivational too.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got to go to France because I worked with Olivier Vatine on this French album. So, I mean, I've been published in France. For me, it was huge because he was one of those artists I looked up to. But a lot of it tends to be through connecting at social gatherings, conventions or cons, as we call them. You know, New York, Atlanta is Dragon Con. San Diego Comic Con is the big one. I mean, that's the con. That is one that you call. You don't call it San Diego Comic Con. You just call it Comic Con. And everybody knows what you're talking about. San Diego has been a big connection place for me throughout the year since I've been attending back, I think 1995 was the first year I went.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, did the opportunity to become the illustrator on the Doctor Who comic book come through some of these types of meetings?
Doctor Who directly came out of San Diego Comic Con.
Okay.
IDW had acquired the rights to Doctor Who in 2006, I believe it was. It was a year after the relaunch, the new Who, as we call it, mm-hmm. in 2005 with Chris Eccleston. I've always been a lifelong fan of Doctor Who. And I didn't really have a connection to that company. But I learned that a friend of mine at our studio mate was drawing G.I. Joe for that company. And I was like, Robert, I was like, man, you have got to introduce me to the editor. I'm like, please, please introduce me. I'm saying, I'm just a huge fan of Doctor Who, lifelong fan since the late 70s. And he took me over there and introduced me to the editor. And the editor's like, you know, Kelly, I really like your stuff, but, you know, we're booked up for the next year. There's absolutely nothing I can give you for the next year. I was like, that's okay. I said, you know, just a fill-in issue, a one-shot, a pin-up, anything, I'll take it. You know, just please keep me in mind. He goes, okay, well, it's going to be a year. I was like, that's fine. So after San Diego, I come home, and about a month afterwards, I get an email from the editor going, knock, knock, opportunity. Mm-hmm. So, and that was really, I was asked to do issue 4 of Doctor Who, The Forgotten.
And then since then, how many more issues have you done?
Altogether, I've done 12 issues of Doctor Who. It's really amazing how my comic book art career, you know, started to solidify with Doctor Who coming out again. So they just kind of both came together at the same time. And like I said, I've always liked Doctor Who. And to be able to work on that property has just been an amazing experience. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, and the latest one I did was Prisoners of Time, issue 12, which is a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who.
Yeah, and you got to draw all 11 Doctors.
Yes.
Doing that. How that must have been a great feeling.
It was an awesome feeling. Intimidating, but awesome. So, and there's the 12th Doctor now. And if you look close enough on the last page, you might happen to spot him. I might have accidentally drawn him in there, tucked away in the background.
I'll have to take a look at that again.
Yeah. Yeah. Close to the light. So I don't know what his costume looks like yet. So I drew his head in there accidentally. All right. So.
Awesome. All right. So everybody out there, so you got to look for that.
Yes.
On the last page.
Yes.
We were talking about Doctor Who a little bit before we started rolling, and you know, we know about Doctor Who, and like you just said, you've been a fan since the 70s. So, believe it or not, there's still people out there who don't know about Doctor Who. Maybe now, I think everyone's, you know, the 50th anniversary was such a big deal, and so many media outlets were covering it. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't gotten big already, it's, I think, really getting big now. Mm-hmm. So the next Doctor has he's got a lot of weight on his shoulder.
Well, I think Peter Capaldi is the right guy to have that weight on his shoulders. He can pull it off.
Yeah, so, I'm really excited. Yeah. So how about you give listeners just kind of like a brief overview of Doctor Who in general so far?
Wow. Well, 50 years we'll cover in 1 minute. No.
Excellent.
Well, Doctor Who, basically, if you go back and watch the very first episode that came out in 1963 called An Unearthly Child, it is essentially the same show as it was back then as it is now. It's about a gentleman from another planet called Gallifrey, and he's a time traveler, and he can regenerate. And the idea behind the regeneration is you can have another actor step into the role. So you have this main character called the Doctor. The Doctor might stick around for a few years our time, but really he might have aged 200 or 300 years. So they'll have another actor come in and still play the same character, but he just ages. And he travels around with companions, mostly from Earth. And again, he travels around in a blue box called a, you know, police box that you would have seen in Britain in the 50s and 60s. And it's a time traveling machine, so he can go basically anywhere in time and space.
That was a really good overview.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, good job. You consolidated to 50 years. In about it's a little more than a minute, but that's okay. You did good. Take me through a day of, you know, you're getting up and you have an assignment or you have some panels you need to work on that day. How does that work?
Well, my real day starts off with my real full-time job.
Okay.
So I actually, that's the dirty little secret, as I call it. I love my job. I work at VF Jeanswear as a graphic designer, design store displays, posters. The reason I do that is because I like to have a house. I like to be able to pay for my car. I like to take a vacation. I like insurance. And unfortunately, comic books, unless you're that top tier people, you can't make a living full time. It's truly that starving artist type of thing. So basically, that's my real day job. But then when I get projects like this, you know, I work on them at night. And basically, I get a script in from the writer. And my creative process has actually changed over the past couple of years because of technology. Because originally, when you had a script, you know, you sat down at your art table and you had a piece of paper and a pencil and you just start drawing. And if you had an edit or something wrong, you had to either erase it, start over, whatever. You know, nowadays it's completely different because what I do is I actually have something called a Cintiq Wacom tablet. It's a big 21-inch thing and I can actually put it in my lap and draw digitally. So if I want to, I can go ahead and ink digitally 100%. But for me, I still like the feel of an ink pen in my hand. So I'll do my layouts on the computer and then print out like a blue, we call it a blue line, on Bristol board. And then I'll go to my art table and I'll ink that actual page. And the great thing about that is, again, digital. So if there is an edit, you can catch it soon enough. And, you know, or if you draw a hand too big, you can scale it down. So the creative process has really changed. You can move so much quicker and make edits. And it's just completely changed.
You know, geek culture, as it were, you know, and people being really interested in pop culture, stuff that, like you said, when you were young, it was not something to talk about, you know, that you were into comic books, you know, not something you wouldn't talk about with people you're playing sports with. But now it's totally different now. It's changed.
Completely changed. Well, I had a friend who he was watching Doctor Who, too, but we never talked about it. There was no cross talking about Doctor Who. And it wasn't until we were maybe in our 20s that we found out we'd both been watching Doctor Who and talking about it more. So it was just kind of wild. So even your best friends at that time were not talking about it. Move ahead to today, and the culture, comic books, and geekism, or whatever you want to call it, has completely changed. It's completely accepted now. You know, you're seeing mothers give gifts to their kids, like graphic novels to their kids for Christmas. You know, my wife went to San Diego Comic-Con with me for the first time this year, and she is not into comic books at all. She'll watch Doctor Who with me every once in a while. But she had a blast just going out there and seeing all the artists and the different things that people put out there. It's just amazing. So it's just completely changed. And I think a lot of that has to do with probably, you know, Harry Potter, Doctor Who. And, you know, I think Iron Man, when the first Iron Man movie came out, I saw a huge shift in the demographics of it. So it's just all these things kind of coming together. And, you know, accepting, just being more open to it.
That's a good point. The Harry Potter point, you're the first person I've ever talked to about this. Our oldest daughter, who's now just about to turn 10, she was a big Harry Potter fan. And it felt like it went from Harry Potter to Doctor Who. And it wasn't just her. It was like other friends. Like, she's in fourth grade. Her and her other friends, like her friend had a Doctor Who themed birthday party, you know, at 9 years old.
Oh, I want one of those.
Yeah.
Wow.
Me too. His mom made a TARDIS cake. It was pretty awesome. So yeah, it's a great point. I think it's a shifting culture. And I think that's good too. You know, that when I was a kid too, I was thought of like, oh, this is great, imaginative, creative, fun stuff. And it's great that it's something, you know, not to hide anymore and something to be, you know, celebrated.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Kelly.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Greensboro-based artist Kelly Yates. You can meet Kelly on Saturday, December 7th at Geeksboro Cafe in Greensboro. Kelly will be giving an artist talk, doing a live drawing illustration that will be projected on a large screen, and telling stories about his experiences interacting with the creative team behind Doctor Who. The event begins at 2 p.m. For Triad Arts Weekend, I'm Eddie Garcia.
That was Eddie Garcia. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. My name's David Ford, and when we get back from the short break, it's time for this. You guessed it. The University of North Carolina School of the Arts annual production of the Nutcracker Ballet is back and just as beautiful as ever. The amazing student production is raising scholarship funds for one of the greatest arts institutions in the country, right here in the Piedmont Triad. Oh yeah, it's UNCSA, and executive producer and general manager Catherine Laidlaw is pumped. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. My next guest is University of North Carolina School of the Arts executive producer and general manager Catherine Laidlaw. Catherine's no stranger to enormous student productions. Since 2009 at the school, she's overseen the production of UNCSA's Oklahoma, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring celebration at Carolina Performing Arts, and, of course, the annual Nutcracker Ballet. This year, during its 9-day run at the Stevens Center, this incredible annual student production raises money for scholarships while bringing world-class performance quality to Triad audiences. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Prior to Catherine's arrival on the UNCSA campus back in 2009, she was busy on Broadway, and her Tony-nominated revival credits there include Gypsy, The Elephant Man, and Death of a Salesman. Catherine was also heavily involved in original Broadway productions like Top Dog Underdog, the off-Broadway spoof Debbie Does Dallas, and London productions of Ragtime and others. Couple that theater background with Catherine's experience brand marketing for the Coca-Cola Company and Hanes Brands, and you get someone supremely prepared for the task at hand. So we see an amazing production. We hear great music. But what all is going on behind the scenes? Give us an inkling as to the things that have to come together, some of the ones that are on the top of your radar as this rolls out.
Well, you know, the School of Dance begins its process in September with casting, doing auditions, that sort of thing. And they basically, I've added up, it's about 300 plus hours of rehearsal that get us to the point where they are prepared to perform in front of, you know, an almost full house at the Stevens Center. Our School of Design Production, they begin their process in October. And our School of Music, you know, several weeks of preparation that go into learning that score and practicing it and then coming together with the School of Dance. And then there's all of the other elements of the production that, you know, you can't possibly sort of appreciate when you're sitting there in the audience. But we have 180 costumes. So 180 costumes and 80 members in the cast. And so just with fittings alone, we do something like 325 fittings. And that occupies about 75 hours worth of time. We have something, I think it's about 320 pairs of shoes that are used in the production. So there's a lot to keep track of. And we have brilliant professionals and faculty members that are in charge of this. But our students are treated as professionals coming into this production. There are huge expectations for their commitment, their effort, their ability to, you know, follow the rules and participate as they should in the production, whether it's what time they arrive to the theater or that they take charge of their costume and it's put exactly where it's meant to be so it can be laundered. It's a highly complicated series of moving parts that has to come together.
And this is a student production. What does that mean?
Soup to nuts. There are students who are sweeping the snow off the stage after Act One. There are students in the pit. They are students who are running the cues. There are students who are dancing every single one of the roles in the production, except, you know, we do have a couple of guest artists. But it is entirely being performed and being run by students.
What do you hear from the students? What sorts of feedback do you get from them?
Well, you know, obviously Nutcracker offers this tremendous opportunity, you know, for the dancers, for them to really refine their technique so that as they're rehearsing this incredibly complicated choreography, I mean, it's difficult. It would be difficult for professionals in some of those principal parts. You know, I think one of the things that they're learning is once they sort of get past the point where they've really kind of, if not mastered, their role, they have their training, their technique, their practice of the choreography, then they begin to be able to put their own individual stamp on it and to express the role. And I think that's the easiest sort of example I can use, but I would say that the same is true for our technicians and our designers, is how they're going to take their individual assignment and get the work done, but get it done in their own way.
Obviously, for listeners now, you can get a sense that UNCSA does not go halfway with these productions. I mean, this is
you
a
sure
full
don't.
Bore, and that includes the guest artists, beginning with the ABT conductor, the American Ballet Theater conductor, Charles Barker.
He is a wonderful dance conductor, one of the finest in the world. He's also a wonderful human being.
What does he bring? If you sat in a rehearsal, what sort of dynamic is there, and what's special about his approach?
You know, he's very precise. He's very observant. You know, he has specific feedback that he gives to the individual musicians. So when he's making corrections, I think that he's highly articulate. But he never makes his corrections in such a way that I've ever seen that could be intimidating or cowing to the students. I almost feel like everything he does empowers them.
It's a nice combination, clarity and empowering. That's what you
want
in a conductor.
Yeah, he's the real deal.
Yeah. Speaking of the real deal, tell us about this year's featured soloists.
We have one of our proudest accomplishments at the School of the Arts, an alumna of our School of Dance, Jillian Murphy, who's a principal with American Ballet Theater and one of the most coveted, sought-after ballerinas of her generation. It's interesting, you know, Susan Jaffe, our dean of dance, who is great friends with Jillian, continues to coach her. Jillian is almost the Susan Jaffe of her generation, and, you know, she's another quintessential American ballerina who is just, the New York Times is in love with her, and why shouldn't we all be? She's a brilliant technician. She's virtually flawless in her technique, and she's so powerful as a dancer. So my jaw regularly, it just drops when I watch Jillian dance, and I know a lot of people feel that way.
And I should point out that Susan Jaffe, a longtime premier ballerina with ABT for like to the tune of 2 decades.
Yes, 20-year long career. So Jillian will be joining us, and she'll be partnered with a principal dancer from New York City Ballet, Gonzalo Garcia. You know, I always think of him, he's like a firecracker. He's got this tremendous power, and there'll just be a moment when he's dancing and it's like he explodes. He's just a terrific, terrific dancer and a heck of a nice guy.
University of North Carolina School of the Arts executive producer and general manager Catherine Laidlaw. The incredible UNCSA student production of The Nutcracker runs December 13th through the 22nd at the Stevens Center, with evening performances at 7:30 and weekend matinees at 2. featured guest artists Gillian Murphy, the Sugar Plum Fairy, and Gonzalo Garcia, her Cavalier Prince, will dance their respective roles on Friday night, December 13th, and Thursday night, the 19th. There will be a special opening night post-concert reception on the 13th, where Prime Orchestra ticket holders can rub elbows with the renowned featured guests. Much of the proceeds from ticket sales to the Nutcracker will go directly in support of UNCSA student scholarships, and you'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin, and our intern is Kirsten Bowman. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes at WFDD.org. I want to remind you we've got two special editions of Triad Arts Weekend coming up in December, Triad Holiday Celebration 1 and 2. For Triad musicians, please email me an MP3 of your best holiday performances. The address is triadarts@wfu.edu. And Triad writers and actors can send me an MP3 of your winter holiday poem, short story, or dramatic reading. Keep it 5 minutes or less in length if you would, and we'll consider including it in the broadcast as well. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.